Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dar Jamail. He's an award-winning journalist and author who's a full-time staff reporter for TruthApp.org. He's currently working on a book about abrupt climate change called The End of Ice. So first, as always, thank you for your tremendous work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Derek.
So what do you mean by The End of Ice?
I mean that quite literally. While the title might sound a bit over the top to a lot of people, if we simply look at the science that's coming out of as far as predictions of around the fate of global glaciers and ice sheets, as well as what's happening in the Arctic and Antarctic right now, coupled with just what we are witnessing at the moment, I think the title's quite accurate. And for example, just barely over 2 months ago, in the middle of November, for global sea ice, we're talking about all sea ice, both in the Antarctic as well as in the Arctic, they saw the greatest deviation from average in recorded history. Sea ice was 1.5 million square miles below average. So that's the same equivalent of 40% of the total land area of the entire United States. That's how much less ice there was than below average for the globe, just basically roughly 2 months ago. And if we look at other scientific reports, we can see there was one that came out about 2 years ago that said that by the year 2100, between 70% and 99% of all the glaciers in the Himalaya will be gone by 2100. Another report that came out roughly a year ago covering British Columbia. So we're talking about all the coastal area from basically where I live in Washington State up to Alaska, and then of course paralleling Alaska, even further up towards the Yukon, towards the base of the Yukon. So we're talking about a massive amount of glacier ice. And the study showed that between 79% and 90% of that will be gone by 2100. So if you think about, look at Kluane National Park, look at the coastal systems. Anyone that's ever been up in those areas, you get an idea that we are talking about basically the brunt of land ice, the vast majority of all land ice on the planet being gone by 2100. And these are already studies that are now a year and 2 years old, and everything keeps ramping up. So the book is about abrupt climate change, ice being one of the key indicators where it's the most visible to see how fast this is happening. But I'm also looking into ocean acidification, oceanic warming, what's happening to trees, and of course, wildlife, and then ultimately humans.
So you talked a bit there about glaciers. Can you talk specifically about, I guess, can you do three little sub introductions of Arctic ice, Greenland ice, and Antarctic ice, and what's happening to them?
Sure. I'm going to actually start with Greenland. Greenland has, as most people following climate change have been aware of now for several years, Greenland has consistently been seeing unprecedented warming. Within the last couple of years, we had 1 month where literally 99% of the surface of Greenland was melting simultaneously. And scientists up there studying it, once they got their jaws up off the ground, had just been shaking their heads and using words like unprecedented and record setting. I mean, that's now common lexicon now for what's happening in Greenland. If the entire Greenland ice sheet were to go, we're talking about tens of feet being added to global sea level rise, and it is in the process of going. Now, in the entirety, that's going to take a long, long time, but that said, there's enough melting already happening that things like the Atlantic Meridional Circulation Current, or Ocean Circulation rather, the AMOC, another study came out that showed, factoring in with increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere, as well as the dramatic melting of the Greenland ice sheet, dumping so much cold, fresh water into the North Atlantic, that those things are combining to dramatically slow the AMOC to the point where they're even predicting a collapse possible within 300 years, which, of course, brings total catastrophic shifts to global weather patterns, not even to talk about the direct ramifications of what that means to North America and Northwestern Europe, essentially being put back into an abrupt ice age. So we are talking about some apocalyptic scenarios playing out based even just on what's happening in Greenland alone and its impacts to that part of the hemisphere. And then if we move to the Arctic, like I just said, we're seeing record levels of sea ice melting, record low levels of sea ice extent. The Navy came out with a study that was published about 4 years ago now, and they actually predicted 2016 plus or minus 3 years as being their prediction of when the Arctic would no longer have sea ice. The mainstream scientific community is still saying we're looking at between 20 and 30 years now. That's down from a 40-year prediction as of a couple of years ago. But they're still staying pretty far out, like 20 to 30 years now, until we see a summer with a completely ice-free Arctic. I still think that there's a very possible chance as the melting there continues to accelerate and temperatures continue to increase, that we could still well see an ice-free Arctic sometime within the next year or two. So that's the Arctic. And of course, the ramifications for that ecologically, we're seeing massive species migrations, invasive species coming up into the Arctic that could never survive there before as temperatures increase both in the atmosphere and underwater. And then of course, species extinctions coming right up against extinction. The iconic polar bear, of course, its days are numbered. They're having to swim further and further for food that's either there or not, and more often than not, it's no longer there. So as seas migrations and availability are changing, and seas are having trouble getting food, so therefore polar bears are having food. Another thing that's happening to polar bears is since they are having to swim further and further to get seals, they're now becoming prey for the Greenland shark as well as killer whales as they're being exposed, having to swim tens and tens of extra miles just to try to find food. So that's, of course, speeding up they're coming up against the threshold of extinction. So just to give you an idea, other things in the Arctic, reindeer in Siberia are now actually shrinking in size because they have less food. So all these types of things are happening up in the Arctic, as the ice is going away, as the permafrost is melting. We'll have to not call it permafrost anymore. And that's, of course, releasing higher levels of methane than ever up into the atmosphere. And I think we talked about this last time I was on your show, Derek, about the methane bomb, which NASA has been warning us about for several years now, that methane being a far more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2, over a 20-year time scale, it's 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2, and still 20 times as potent over a 100-year time scale. And unprecedented levels of methane now being released from the melting Arctic up into the atmosphere. And then, you know, quickly down to the Antarctic, there's these massive ice sheets like the Larsen Sea Ice Shelf, which are essentially coming undone. NASA recently released a photograph that revealed a 300-foot-wide massive rift. I think in places it was nearly a mile deep, 300 feet wide, where literally a giant chunk of the Larsen Sea is about to release. Once it does, that's going to release an iceberg the size of the state of Delaware. So these ice sheets are literally starting to collapse and disintegrate and break apart, that thus unplugging the massive amount of inland ice and land ice behind them that will then be released and start flowing down into the ocean as well. And again, even scientists up there, whether they're talking about the Larsen Sea or another massive rift that recently was discovered along the Pine Island Glacier, that show that there are several massive Antarctic glaciers that are now being melted from below, from warming sea level as well as also record temperatures in the air down there. So scientists are using words again like unprecedented and using phrases like we've never seen anything like this. As far as what's going on down there. So it's happening everywhere. And the Arctic, Antarctic and Greenland I think the most obvious and glaring warning signs that we have with these three so-called canaries in the coal mine of this is what's happening. They're already – those places, and particularly the Arctic, are already in a world where they're seeing regularly 8 to 12 degrees C above average temperatures on what's becoming a more common basis. I mean, even up in the Arctic in late December, we were seeing temperatures 50 degrees above normal. And to give you an idea, there's a very simple trick. I mean, you know, all this is very arbitrary and pretty scientific, and it's easy to feel kind of removed from it. Oh, it's the Arctic. It's so far away. But think about how important this place is for the planet and regulation of all global weather and systems. So just where are you right now? And add 50 degrees to that temperature and think about how normal that would feel to you.
So I am in Northern California in temperate rainforests in early February, and it is the same temperature that it always is here, which is about 50 degrees. And so what you're saying is all of a sudden plop myself out at 100 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I encourage everyone listening to do that. And then that gives you an idea of what's happening in the Arctic right now.
And I want to come back to ecological effects in a minute, but before then, I want to say that I'm guessing that the political response to all of this is to propose absolutely dramatic changes in how we live so that we don't kill the planet.
If only, you know, and instead the political response, as we all are seeing, is I don't think it would be possible for the U.S. government now, led by this megalomaniac fascist, to deregulate the fossil fuel industry and all the corporate power that's responsible for the murder of the planet. They couldn't possibly deregulate it and charge full steam ahead any faster than they are by Pruitt now being the head of the EPA, by former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, literally today as we speak, is officially confirmed as Secretary of State. I'm stammering because I'm speechless. It's still, I don't think it's hard for me to get my head around the absolute insanity of this, that it couldn't be, the warning signs we're getting from the planet are couldn't be more clear. The planet is literally screaming at us about showing what is happening, whether we talk about ocean acidification or what I just spoke of, just this, those cursory broad brushstrokes about what's happening to ice around the planet, to the extinction rate increasing, to, you know, even human beings, you know, it's clear that there's not going to be food and water available for the majority of the planet into the not so distant future. The signs couldn't be more clear. And yet the political response is, yeah, we get that. We're going to stomp on the accelerator with everything we have and charge forward into this abyss at a speed than we far faster than we ever have before.
You know, we don't need to go here for very long, but something that has been central to my work from the very, very beginning of my writing is that this culture has a death urge and is going to do whatever it takes to kill the planet. The problems are not just, and once again, we don't have to go there, but it is, I wish that it brought me some joy or even satisfaction to be vindicated, but it just makes me sad.
It really is. I mean, to me, it's unconscionable that this kind of devastation is happening to the natural world, and it's, I have so much anger towards the political systems that are responsible for this and for the majority of the population that either through apathy or fear or greed or whatever their reasons either allow this to happen or support it, its continuance. And so even more than I lament for the fate of humans, I lament the polar bears and, you know, hummingbirds and all these other species that are completely innocent and have nothing to do with their worlds being completely changed to the point where they don't have enough food and water to survive or habitat to live in. That I think more than anything today brings me more grief, you know, as far as what's happening across the globe.
I completely agree. And that would be a good segue into ecological stuff, but I want to ask one more question, which is, one of the things that horrifies me about the Arctic is, now that there is a Northwest Passage, they are excited about it. So can you talk about the Greenland, mineral rush and the, Northwest Passage, both what that means and also the cruise ships and various transportation, because all of that makes me about as angry as anything does. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. Absolutely. Yeah. And I haven't written about the mineral rush in Greenland, but I've certainly read some excellent articles about it, and it's stunning. But yeah, in short, in Greenland, as the ice across there continues to melt at record rates, it's basically exposing more and more land, and a lot of Greenland is now being exposed that was completely inaccessible to mining and drilling before. So things like iron ore, lead, zinc, diamonds, gold, rare earth metals, uranium, and oil are now starting to become accessible in Greenland, and their government, in an effort to become independent of Denmark, is really 100% on board to the exploitation of those aforementioned resources. So this is extremely disconcerting, and despite the fact that it's a native-led government, they're saying, look, we are not going to be a museum for white people. We see the changes coming. We are simply adapting to them for our own good. And so that's their position. So it really looks as though there's really nothing that could stop this from happening. And needless to say, that's a great tragedy. Not only is it going to leave permanent lasting scars around Greenland, but it's only going to, of course, act to further speed up the dramatic decline of that whole biosphere and ecosystem. And then also related, you know, as you bring up, with the new passageway opened up in the north, the Northwest Passage from the melting sea ice. I did a story at the end of last summer, actually it was in September, about how a cruise ship company, Los Angeles-based Crystal Cruises, they ran through their first cruise ship this past summer through the Northwest Passage. And this, hopefully people listening haven't eaten very recently. It really truly is sickening. But this is it's an 820-foot long cruise ship called the Crystal Serenity that sailed from Seward, Alaska, up around the west coast of Alaska, and then all across the Northwest Passage, and then back down and landing in New York. So it was a rather long cruise. It was a 13-deck cruise ship with 535 staterooms, multiple swimming pools, a golf driving range, a putting green, a casino, spa, fitness center, hair salon, movie theater, and 24-hour room service. It carried 1,700 passengers and crew, and the lowest room you could get on that cruise ship started at $22,000 per person. So it's a 1% cruise company. The company is already selling rooms for another cruise for next summer. This one I did believe sell out. It did sell out when it went across last summer, and it took them a month. It was a little over a 30-day cruise, and they had even some penthouse rooms there with their own private veranda that went for $120,000 per person. In those rooms, for anyone listening that might be keen to try to go next year, it's a 1,000-square-foot room with its own living room, dining area, flat screen TVs in every part of the room, and a personal butler service. So as the Arctic is melting and species up there dying off and heading towards extinction, the super rich can go through in their very, very fancy cruise ship and get a firsthand view of this demise.
Maybe they got to see some polar bears drown.
Well, odds are, or at least watch them as they're being attacked by the killer whales and Greenland sharks when they're foraging around trying to find food that's not there.
Maybe they got some videos and they put them on YouTube. You know, this reminds me of, there's a writer, Harlan Ellison, who is horribly misogynist. He's just wretched in every way. And he wrote a short story that became a movie the movie was terrible, called A Boy and His Dog, 1970s movie. It's post-apocalyptic. And the reason I bring it up is because there was one line early in the movie that is, even though he's just horrible in every way, this is, I think, the best line I've ever heard to describe this culture's attitude toward the natural world. In this post-apocalyptic world, women are very scarce. And when a woman is found, she's usually raped to death in this story. And he comes across the body of a woman who had just been killed, the main character does. And he says, oh, this is terrible. This is such a shame. They shouldn't have killed her. She still had a couple uses left in her. And for me, ever since seeing that movie when I was a teenager, that has encapsulated this culture's attitude toward the natural world. That the real pity, the real sorrow of the world dying will be that we weren't able to make that much more money first. We weren't able to take one more cruise before it all went down.
Well, and that's the mindset. I mean, that really encapsulates what we were talking about earlier as far as, okay, the planet's on the way out. We need to make as much money as quickly as possible right now, no matter what the cost. And that's what we are literally seeing enacted now with this Trump administration. And it's sickening. And I think it's also, you know, something to kind of give us all pause and take a deep breath and brace ourselves for what is to come, because it also reminds me, and I've written this in several of my climate dispatches, the saying that I got from Iraqis in the early days of the occupation when I went in there and started reporting in 2003, and Iraqis saw their country burning and they saw what was happening. And it was right before the mass slaughters really began to become a common thing there, carried out at the hands of the U.S. military. And then, of course, you know, with the U.S. orchestrating divide and conquer and turning Iraqis against themselves and funding each side and arming each side, et cetera. And Iraqis saw this coming, and they had this saying, it was today is better than tomorrow. And they knew that things were only going to continue to get worse on a daily basis. And sure enough, 2017, look at Iraq today compared to when Saddam Hussein was in power and before the U.S. decided to come in and do what they were going to do. And I think the same can be said for essentially all aspects of the planet today, whether we talk about it politically or climatologically or for species, that certainly today is better than tomorrow. And I think that, you know, we're all, you know, buckle up. I mean, we're in for the ride. And, you know, as far as with climate disruption, I mean, it's not, you know, how can we mitigate this? How can we change it? But we are in a position now. And I think I said this, long before Trump got elected, but now, of course, it's more true than ever. And it's not, we're going to change anything. We're not going to stop it. We're really not even going to slow it down, but it's more like brace for impact.
So can you talk about, I want to come to ecological effects in the Arctic and Antarctic in a moment, but I've never actually thought much about ecological effects of glaciers. Are you talking about that in your book? And if so, can you talk a little bit about what this means ecologically to the regions that are currently or historically glaciated that will no longer have them? What will that do to the biomes who are there?
That's a very good point, and it is something that most people don't think about. And I didn't really think about it much until I started interviewing a lot of glaciologists and physical scientists and folks like this for one of the chapters I'm doing that's on specifically about what's happening to glaciers. And the most obvious way that I think people can see this, you know, when a glacier melts, what does that mean for the ecology and the biosphere of that area, is what water runoff. So, for example, if there's less glacier there and it's going away and there's less water available every spring and summer when that glacier melts, then everything dependent on that water is going to have a lot more difficult time to survive. So that includes all the plant species right around the toe of the glacier, as well as downstream from those rivers, as well as lakes below those, you know, tens or hundreds of miles away that also depend on that meltwater. And so plant species, animal species, and then lastly, and of course, human beings. So all of these are being dramatically impacted. I mean, and from a human perspective, I wrote recently, I did a short news story on a major crisis happening in Bolivia because of dramatic lack of water, literally riots in the streets and the military being used to go out and try to find water and bring it into the population centers and such, and a destabilizing effect on the government. And the bulk of that, I mean, yes, it was from higher temperatures and yes, it was from less rainfall, but the bulk of that was, look, there's been far less snowpack. So the glaciers, instead of remaining steady or even growing some, are going away rapidly, and some of the biggest glaciers in that country are already gone, and others are very, very close to going away. So that is one very obvious way that, you know, a receding glacier, a melting glacier, and certainly one that goes away entirely, everything that's dependent upon that as a water source is going to go away with it.
It seems that In cold water streams, especially, that fish can be very temperature dependent, and they have a, like, I know trout, salmon have very, they like very cold water for the most part. And so it seems to me also that not only will there be less water, but if, unless I'm just missing something, it seems to me that if you don't have glacier melt coming in with this water that's 33 degrees, that the temperature will also rise in the streams.
That's another extremely good point, and that's another huge effect, and we're already seeing that playing out across Washington and Oregon and parts of Alaska and British Columbia, where salmon runs are being heavily impacted by that, and it's literally the water's too hot. And some of that, of course, has been, you know, when atmospheric temperatures go way up, that's going to have a similar effect, but certainly then less glacier water coming into those streams is going to have that impact also. And then, of course, you know, you're changing the temperature of the water, you're changing the chemistry of the water, and then everything downstream, you know, all the fish, not just salmon, but all the other different types of fish, and then the nutrients that those rivers are capable of dumping into the oceans, that is going to be impacted. So it runs all the way down into even affecting life in the oceans when these glaciers go away. So that's a very important point.
So let's go to the Arctic or Antarctic for ecological effects. And I'm going to tell a quick story, and then I'm going to throw out something that I don't know the answer to. And the quick story is that just has to do with the complexity of oceans. And when I was working on the myth of human supremacy, I looked up some stuff about squid and sperm whales, and in the South Pacific, the one of the constraints for biodiversity is a lack of iron. And part of the reason there's a lack of iron is because they killed so many sperm whales, because sperm whales would go down deep and eat squid, who are evidently very rich in iron, and then they would come up to the top and they would poop them out. And when the whalers killed off so many of the sperm whales, that pump for iron was harmed, greatly harmed. And that then had cascading effects. And my point is just that it's incredibly – that natural communities like that, what people call ecosystems, are very, very complex. Okay, so now what I'm going to throw out is, you know, what about the effects of this sort of ice melt on the base, what they call the base of the food chain, like phytoplankton, krill? Do we have any idea what that will do? I mean, let's forget for a second the invasive species and all that. What will that do to the base of the food chain? Do we have any idea? Does it, will it help harm it? Will it help it? What will it do? Do you know?
It's certainly impacting it. So it kind of like, I would kind of dovetail my answer into what we were just speaking of, where when there's less glacial melt and the temperatures of the rivers increases, and then as those dump into the oceans, that increases on top of already dramatically increasing ocean temperatures, that's having dramatic impact on that. So, for example, one of the things that I'm writing about is how the, it was called the Pacific Ocean blob. And I know you're aware of it, Derek, but you know, and probably a lot of listeners are as well, that with these dramatically increased ocean temperatures, there's been this huge area of the Pacific, off the coast of Alaska, running all the way down to off the coast of Northern California and everything in between of higher temperatures. And so this is causing these algal blooms that are becoming toxic, and everything eating them is becoming toxic and dying. So it's killing off a lot of the food supply. And so one of the effects of this up in Alaska is there is a pencil fish, a forage fish, a bottom feeding forage fish up there that became basically saturated with a lot of this toxic algae, and then everything that eats that fish, all of those toxins accumulate and start going up the food chain. And so this is why, for example, we saw these massive seabirds all through last year, off and on through last year across much of Alaska, these massive seabird die-offs. We saw massive stellar sea lion die-offs and other seal die-offs from Northern California up into Alaska, out across, even well across into the Aleutians. And all of this, from the scientists I've been speaking with, several of them direct, you know, attribute this directly to climate change and the warming ocean temperatures, and causing these kind of, these really dramatic effects that then cascade through the food chain. And as you point out, they always start at the lowest levels and then work their way up. And so, you know, it doesn't, you know, you don't have to be a scientist to understand that when you take things like plankton and phytoplankton and then introduce in, you know, change the chemistry that those organisms live in, and then they become toxic or they die off, and then run that up through the rest of the entire food web. Generally 90% of it relies upon those things, if not closer to 100%, then, you know, it's very clear to see what's going to happen. We're going to have massive unprecedented die-offs. And this is why, you know, there are scientific studies that have come out that talk about, you know, the possibility of all life in the oceans, or at least the vast majority of it, being gone by 2100 at the latest. I mean, there are studies coming out addressing that. One fact that's now even become mainstream, I know National Geographic has reported on this, as have other sources, the leading coral scientists on the planet all agree that without dramatic, immediate global mitigation efforts, which of course we're not going to see, but without something that dramatic, that you'll be hard pressed to find any surviving coral anywhere on the planet by 2050. And given that roughly a quarter of all sea life is dependent on coral for some part of its life, or spends some part of its life in coral, and given that now as we speak, well over a billion people on the planet, fish are their sole source of protein. So you can see where this is going. It's not going to end well.
A creature who gets mentioned sometimes, but not very often, is walruses. What's happening with walruses?
I actually haven't, I can't speak to that. I've focused in on sea lions and fur seals and fish, but I haven't really focused in on walruses. Although I did, publish a brief report, quite a ways back. There was a giant walrus stranding, in Alaska because of lack of sea ice that's normally there. There actually was a rather dramatic photo published showing over 30,000 walruses that had effectively beached themselves on land, exposed land, because of lack of ice for them which is where they would usually find habitat.
So can you find I'm just going to mention that all of the greatest mass extinctions in the history of the planet have been associated with fairly abrupt climate change. And one of the significant causes, so I'm going to ask you about that, and then also that one of the significant causes of extinction in those mass extinctions was dramatic sea level change, because the creatures who live at 0 to 50 feet underwater can't live at 50 to 100 feet underwater, and the creatures who live and coastal areas are among the richest in the world. So go.
Well, as far as previous mass extinction events, I think, you know, I'm going to talk about the biggest one, and because I also think it's the one that what's happening now we have the most in common with, as far as the things that set it in motion. So the Permian mass extinction event occurred 250 million years ago and wiped out 90% of all life on Earth. And the basics of it were ongoing volcanic eruptions over tens of thousands of years in Siberia released enough CO2 into the atmosphere that warmed the planetary temperature enough that the Arctic started to melt. Methane then started to be released at an extremely quick rate, and that then kicked the planetary warming into abrupt warming, and to at a pace that species couldn't adapt or deal with, and 90% of all life on Earth went extinct. And I would argue that what we are doing now is we are introducing more CO2 at a much, much faster rate than was released during that mass extinction. And we are already seeing the effects of the methane starting to be released from the Arctic at ever quickening levels. We are already in officially the sixth mass extinction event, according to scientists. We are in a new era labeled the Anthropocene, because humans are literally changing the entire planet and affecting everything from the chemistry of the oceans to the atmosphere. And we are the prime driver of this, obviously. And so we are at the very front end of this mass extinction event. And as you've talked about for years, we're losing between 150 and 200 species a day, which is far, far higher than a normal background extinction rate, like exponentially higher than what would be considered a normal background extinction rate. And we're the prime driver of this.
And what do you – I know, as a dear friend of mine always says, that the crystal ball is always cloudy. But that same friend also says that if we continue, let's see, what's he say? He says, if we continue on the path, we'll get to where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And, so what do you see? You know, I'm not asking you to say what's going to happen by 2020 or anything like that, but what do you see ecologically happening? I'm not asking politically right now.
Okay. I think that, you know, the broad brushstrokes that I would feel confident in making, and I think, again, most people listening will probably just shake their head and say, yeah, we already know this, but everything's going to continue to speed up the melting of the ice. And I mean, like, not in a linear fashion. Like, for example, you know, a year ago in Alaska, they saw by far and away the highest record temperature for the state for the year. It was something like 6 to 8 degrees above average for the entire year, which was astronomical. Now they're having an extremely cold winter. I mean, they're kind of back to normal. So we have to look at this, you know, in a little bit of a macro view, not, okay, every year it's only going to keep getting hotter and that's how it's going to go. It's going to be up and down, but the overall general trajectory is – things are only going to continue to increase rapidly, looking through the lens of a geologic timescale and not human, although most of what we're talking about we can witness on a human time scale, which is also unprecedented. So temperatures, global temperatures only going to increase because global CO2 content is only continuing to increase. There's nothing to indicate that that's going to slow down whatsoever. And not just in this country, but if we talk about China and India and the, you know, the top three main polluters, which are us and those two, they're only going to continue to increase on an annual basis, for the short to midterm. So extinction rates are going to continue as they are and, it, I think increase at least some, as we go further in along this. You know, ice, as we discussed, is on the way out globally. Not to say that it's all going to completely be gone by X year, but certainly dramatic evidence showing that land ice, across much of the globe, you're going to be hard pressed to find much land ice by 2100, I think, in most places, where it currently exists today. And I think most people who go outside regularly into the mountains, can already see this happening with their own eyes. And then, you know, global conflict as resources like fresh water and arable land to grow food and food availability become more scarce, global conflict is going to increase extremely dramatically. And I think these are things that we're going to see not in most of those, not in tens of years, but, you know, those are visible. Some of them are already happening. And I think the intensification of all of those are going to be very, very apparent, probably even just within a few years from now.
And let's pretend that the question I eventually get to is going to be the end game of all this, that you once again, cloudy crystal ball. At this rate, humans will go extinct, obviously. At this rate, what do you think? Okay, here's what I'm trying to ask. Give me your most realistic case scenario for, and you're making this up, but for 500 years from now, your most realistic case and your best case scenarios. And I'm not even going to ask your worst case scenario because we both know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go ahead and say, for me, the worst case scenario, which I think is actually the most likely scenario, is this culture kills everything except for maybe some bacteria around some vents deep in the ocean. I mean, this culture is going to kill everything. What would you see? How do you see this longer term playing out? Do you see any vertebrates surviving? And best case scenario, I still think, and this could be me in denial, I still think that if all of this madness stopped tomorrow, I still think that the prairies and forests, if they could come back, that they could start sequestering carbon and we would not see absolute runaway global warming. But I could be wrong. So what is your best case long-term scenario and your medium case long-term scenario?
I would say best case would be, for starters, nuclear weapons aren't used. Because I wake up every day now with this administration and see that one hasn't been used. And I think, okay, we have another day. So best case scenario is, nuclear weapons continue to not be used, because once those get used, I think we go to your worst case scenario in about a 4-hour period. So those don't get used. Somehow, the system breaks down fast enough, without taking out huge amounts of the planet with it. So something like what you described would be allowed to happen. Large areas of the oceans are all of a sudden left alone and things can start coming back. Large areas of the surface of the planet are left alone so that things can keep coming back, like prairies and forests and a carbon sequestration, pulling things back down out of the atmosphere and start to occur, particularly since if the brunt of civilization has collapsed, then there'll be far less CO2 being emitted into the atmosphere. Some, but not more than the atmosphere can deal with, as it can deal with a certain amount. So I think that would be best case scenario. And that as far as humans, what's left is that, whatever population survives that transition are awake and aware enough. And I know a lot of people I for sure there are a large number of these people on the planet now that get what it means to live close to the Earth and not live as though we are the dominant species, and do our best to live in harmony with the planet and live in small scattered collectives very close to the Earth, and that so humans do continue, and as many species as possible do continue. I think that would be best case scenario. And with the caveat that that is an absolute pipe dream, and it's really, really hard for me today to see that really having beyond a 0.1% chance of happening. My midterm scenario, which I think gets a little bit more close to being realistic, is I'm urging people, whenever I'm doing radio interviews now, I'm urging people to pick up a copy of, if they don't already have one, of Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism and read it. I think she's a phenomenal thinker. And I think anyone that wants to know what's happening politically and where this is taking us and where this is going in the United States needs to read that book. I feel like we are going into an extremely dark time, and the evidence is in front of us in the news on a daily basis right now. And people need to be aware of that fact and brace themselves and start behaving accordingly, because I feel like that is where we are going in the midterm. And I know I just veered completely away from ecologically speaking and went into the political realm, but I definitely wanted to make sure that I mentioned that before our time runs out.
Great. And so in addition to reading, okay, so the political situation seems a little bit less, a tiny bit less momentum than the ecological situation, because there is, and you know that I think that there is tremendous political momentum, but it seems that it's a little bit easier to try to change a political system than it is to stop methane that's already coming out. I could be wrong. But in any case, what do you want people to do? And once they read that book, and we have like 3 minutes left, once they read that book, what do you want them to do? What do you want actually people, they read the book, they read Hannah Arendt's book, and they recognize how bad things are. They recognize ice is going, and then what do you want them to do to actually help the real physical world?
I think encourage other people to read it and to pay very, very close attention and be aware of what is happening and be willing to sustain the gaze of this horror show that's unfolding between us, because only if we have a clear map of reality and what's happening can we behave accordingly. And I think people need to act as if, hey, look, the war is on. They have absolutely declared war. And so what can I do where I live to protect what is here? And that means not just taking care of myself, where can I get food and water, but I live, for example, in a bunch of trees, and what can I do to protect these trees? And start thinking that way, because it is a matter of, can we work to save one more species? Can we work to give this other particular species just a little bit more time? Because if we do, then that's the best thing we can do to give nature at least a little bit of a chance going forward from this time.
Well, thank you so much, Dar. I mean, you know that you're one of my heroes, and I would like to thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dar Jamail. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Derek.